From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The number of children diagnosed with autism is increasing, according to a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control. We learn more about research into the autism spectrum and about resources to assist families. And we hear from writer Alyssa Rock and her teenage son, Connor, who has autism.
So, Connor, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A chef. I want to enter 25 Language Lane and room 101.
So you want to be a chef and you want to live on your own?
With my roommate.
So you want to have a roommate and live on Rambling Ridge Lane?
Then, in a new senior portrait, we hear from a woman who lifts weights, line dances, and lives in the moment. Plus, we revisit Tom Hall's conversation about politics and paganism with the late Margot Adler, author and NPR correspondent. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. An estimated 1 out of 60 children in Maryland has an autism spectrum disorder. That's higher than the estimate of a couple years ago. This past spring, we got a new awareness of how common the disorder is from a report conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In a moment, we'll hear from the Bloomberg School's principal investigator on that report and from the director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders at Kennedy Krieger Institute. First, we want to get a picture of what it's like for a family who has a child with ASD, an autism spectrum disorder. Alyssa Rock has two sons, Connor and Aiden. Connor is 15 years old, and he has moderate autism. Alyssa Rock interviewed her son Connor in April, and we learned a little more about him.
Okay, Connor, what would you like to talk about today?
To cook thin cake.
You like to cook cakes?
Yes.
What did you make yesterday with Ian? You need help? How about snickerdoodle cookies?
Yes, with Aaron.
What else do you like to do, Connor, besides cooking?
Arts and crafts.
Arts and crafts?
Yes.
What kind of things do you do in arts and crafts?
Mugs and bird feeders and bird houses and stools and crates.
You paint mugs and bird feeders?
And bird houses.
And bird houses?
And stools.
Okay.
And crates.
And crates. So, Connor, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A chef. I want to enter 25 Rambling Ridge Lane and room 101.
So you want to be a chef and you want to live on your own?
I want to enter 25 Rambling Ridge Lane and room 101 with my roommate.
So you want to have a roommate and live on Rambling Ridge Lane?
And I want Catherine Keene to live there with Connor at your new place.
Oh, you've already picked out a roommate?
Yes!
Oh, that's exciting.
You can do it when you graduate from school.
Yeah, we have to get through school first.
Sorry.
That's okay, though. You gotta learn things to be a chef, right?
Right.
What kind of things do you need to be a chef?
Good language.
Right. And what about your behavior?
Good.
Appropriate behavior?
Being appropriate.
Yeah.
Especially.
That's right. Thanks for talking to me, Connor.
Bye.
That was Connor Wade being interviewed by his mom, Alyssa Rock. When I spoke with Alyssa in April, I asked her when Connor had been diagnosed with autism.
He was diagnosed at age 3.5.
And was that a long time coming? I mean, had you noticed things or?
He seemed typical until shortly before his second birthday. He regressed and lost a number of skills, his eye contact, his language that he had had. He was speaking in short sentences and he stopped sleeping through the night. And so we began a 1.5-year long journey of specialists and different medical providers trying to figure out what exactly was going on with him.
That was in 2002. We knew less about autism spectrum disorders than now. What were the resources like for you then, for Connor?
Well, we were able to get him started on speech therapy and occupational therapy. There's a therapy, applied behavioral analysis. It took us a while to find out about that, and that's really intensive behavioral intervention. So I would say resources were hard to come by in terms of trying to figure out what exactly to do to help our son.
What kind of services does Connor get?
Well, over the years, we've done a lot of different things. We did occupational therapy, speech therapy. We also did a number of biomedical interventions with him. He had a special doctor that we went to Richmond, Virginia to consult with. We did a lot of work in our home with providers and therapists coming into the home for a long time.
But he's in school.
That's correct. He was schooled in our home for 6 or 7 years. And then when he saw his younger brother getting on the bus and going to school, he decided he wanted to go to school.
That's Alyssa Rock here on Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Alyssa, we're talking with her about her experiences raising Connor, age 15, who is on the autism spectrum. Your younger son, Aiden, mm-hmm. does not have autism.
That's correct.
Neurotypical is the scientific description. When he was old enough to observe that there were some differences between him and his brother, how did you explain that to Aiden?
I don't know. We've always just been very open and honest and frank with Aiden about his brother and his autism. It wasn't like we sat down and had a big conversation, which is, oh, your brother has autism, and that means his brain's developing differently, but that's okay, and that's just Connor. That's just who he is.
What kind of impact do you think Connor's situation has on Aiden?
I think that it's been very overwhelming for Aiden. Our son has had a tremendous amount of behavioral challenges.
Connor,
mm-hmm. And that means that Aiden has been targeted with aggression. He's seen a lot of tantrum behavior. Connor's behavior can be unpredictable in public sometimes. And as Aiden's grown older, that's been harder. Now that he's in middle school, you know, he's very socially aware. But Aiden is an amazing person, and he loves his brother very much. And we just all do the best we can to support Connor.
How does the situation affect you and your husband?
It's stressful, but we try to maintain our partnership. We're a team, and we both just really want the best for our kids and for, you know, obviously to support Connor the best that we can.
You write a blog called Rock Autism Experience, and you write very candidly about you and your husband's experiences raising Connor. Why did you start the blog?
Originally, I started it around 2004, but just to keep friends and family kind of up to date about what was going on with Connor. Then I really started writing it to really help people understand what the challenges were that our family was facing. I don't think everybody really understood what a struggle we were going through and, you know, that we still go through. And why exactly it's so difficult sometimes to raise Connor.
What is it that you think people most don't understand about family life that involves autism?
I guess just that, you know, we're not just upset that our child's not going to, you know, ever be president of the United States. You know, there are very real everyday things that my son struggles with all the time. At 15, you know, still toileting can be a problem. Sometimes it feels like it's just a one-way street where I'm doing all the work in the relationship and I'm not getting anything out of him. And that there's an overwhelming amount of planning and routine that we have to follow to keep him on the level. So I think people don't understand kind of the day-to-day grind it can be. And, you know, I love my son very much. He's a wonderful person. But he does have a significant behavior problem, and that is also very difficult. It's difficult emotionally. It's difficult physically, trying to manage when he does have at Kenny Krieger, they call it a burst, takes the emotion out of it when he has a burst. Because a 15-year-old, 130-pound kid having tantrum behavior is very hard. So I think people don't understand that as much.
What would you like people to know about children with ASD? We were talking about families, but...
Sure. I would like people to know that children with autism spectrum disorder can have very fulfilling, productive, wonderful lives, but they need those support and the services from their families and their communities. And by that, I mean someone needs to help families afford the care that their child needs, whether that's social skills groups or whether that means in-home awake 24-hour care for an individual who's more affected. I feel like our community is failing these kids in many ways because it is so expensive to give them the supports that they need, but that's what they need to be successful.
I really appreciate your giving us this look at it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alyssa Rock writes the blog Rock Autism Experience. She's got two sons, Connor and Aiden. Connor is 15 years old. He has autism. We heard from him earlier.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about autism. The report I mentioned about the prevalence of ASD was conducted by the CDC and researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. They found 1 in 68 children nationwide affected by ASD, an increase of nearly 30% in 2 years. In Maryland, the incidence is a bit higher, 1 in 60 children, more common among boys than girls. Producer Jamila Kay spoke with Dr. Lee Cheng Lee, a psychiatric epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. Dr. Lee is the principal investigator for the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network in Maryland. She said it's difficult to tease out the factors that have led to an increase in diagnosing autism year after year.
The increase is likely due to, in part, a broadened definition of autism spectrum disorder, greater awareness among the public and professionals, and the way children receive services in their local communities. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to tease these factors apart to quantify how much each of these factors contribute to the increase over time.
That's Dr. Lee Cheng Lee, a psychiatric epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. She spoke to Maryland Morning in April. We also spoke with Dr. Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. Dr. Lee had pointed to greater awareness of autism and a broader definition, so I asked Dr. Landa what other factors could contribute to this increased prevalence of autism diagnosis.
I think Dr. Lee has it right. I think we really have gotten better to tune in, so to speak, at the kinds of social communication difficulties these folks are having, being able to actually ask the right questions to understand the nature of their impairment around their social cognitive difficulties and also around these restricted patterns of behavior and interests.
And of course, autism disorder covers a spectrum. Are researchers seeing an increase in the number of kids who are high-functioning, low-functioning, Asperger's? I mean, is the increase sort of seen across the spectrum, or is it concentrated in one part?
What the CDC report is indicating is that the increase is in the children who are not having the intellectual impairments. It's the kids who are having, as you said, higher functioning.
That's where we're seeing the increase. The report says that boys are 5 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Do we know why?
We really don't. There is research looking into this to understand, is it something related to the sex chromosomes? Is it related to hormonal factors? We really don't have an answer to this right now.
Why does autism affect more white children than children of color?
For right now, I mean, there's certainly research going on looking into possible neurobiological factors, but right now we have to point to some factors that might be cultural, maybe the way that certain behaviors are viewed. So in some cultures, being able to entertain yourself and play without seeking out social attention from adults is not a bad thing. There's also difficulties in some cultural groups where maybe the mother is concerned, but there are taboos against her talking about it. So, I mean, these are complex things that we need to understand more about.
What went through your I mean, I'm sure you sort of saw this report gestating, so I guess you didn't have like a moment of, oh my gosh, but I mean, was there a moment like that when you were struck by something about the new data on incidence of autism?
Well, the biggest thing that hits me is that really autism is not a rare disorder, and that, you know, at least 1% of the population is affected with this disorder, and we really must be working extra hard to identify it as early in life as possible, because that's when the brain is most plastic. Then for kids who aren't getting identified early, and even for those who are, we need to be equipping teachers to really know what to do with students in their classroom who have this disorder in a way that's going to give them the building blocks for success in education and life afterward. I think we also have to equip parents with strategies for living their life with autism. You know, they have to be able to stay strong. They have to be able to get rest. They have to have a peer group. They have to have supports. And they have to be able to keep a positive attitude. And I know that sounds maybe impossible against some of the challenges, but we have to, as a society, embrace families who have needs, whether it's autism or anything. Another thing that's really important in the field of autism is to understand that when you have autism, very often there's a co-occurring other health challenge. That can be a GI problem, it can be sleep problems, it can be behavioral challenges such as aggression, self-injury, it can be epilepsy. It's important for physicians to keep their eyes open in their patients who have an autism spectrum disorder, just so that they're constantly monitoring whether one of these other things is hitting the scene and needs to be worked up.
That's Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute, here on Maryland Morning at 8:1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about new research and resources for parents with children on the autism spectrum. Dr. Li-Ching Li told us that kids aren't being diagnosed as early as they could be.
On average, children are diagnosed at the age of 4 years and 8 months in Maryland. Even though the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder can be determined as early as age two, so there is much work ahead of us to catch up and close the gap.
Dr. Landa, how does early intervention affect a child's outcomes?
We have to think about what are the core impairments of autism. And it really comes down to, it's a social disability, there's difficulty learning the nuances of language, and there are fixations or tendencies to repetitive behavior. And if we allow a child to go on through development in the first 3 to 4 years of life with those difficulties and not intervene, imagine how year by year they get further behind their peers and less equipped to be able to establish friendships and to create for themselves the kinds of social interactions that really promote social and communication learning. We can change children's joint attention or social attention abilities, their ability to communicate effectively and to gesture and to learn to imitate other kids and to play with other kids. We can change that in a 1- and 2-year-old with autism.
You and I talked about a year ago. What is new since then, or more developed since then, in terms of initiatives and resources for children and their parents?
Well, one of the things that we've done is to create something for the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's a 9-minute tutorial. And basically, it shows 3 pairs of 1-year-olds, one without autism and one who's showing signs of risk for ASD. And these videos are narrated, and so it points out for families and doctors what these early signs look like. So that's a really great resource.
Are we anywhere closer to understanding the cause of autism?
I think one of the big pieces of news is that the behavioral abnormalities come on very slowly and gradually in most babies and really aren't showing up in mid-infancy in the way that most people would expect them to. So the very earliest signs that something is awry actually involve the motor system, and they can be very mild signs, and they don't promise that you're going to have autism. But if there's a family history of autism and then there are these motor delays, even if they're subtle, families want to make sure that they connect with somebody who can give them ideas to strengthen their child's development.
Does that research indicate that we're going to be able to diagnose autism spectrum disorder even earlier?
Well, what we've found through our studies of infant siblings of children with autism is that 20% of subsequently born children to a family who already has a child with autism are going to have autism. And another 30% will have something milder, another type of language or social delay. And so through studying these baby siblings of children with autism from the time they're infants and until they're older, we actually can see what those risk signs are for autism. And I do believe that someday we will be able to identify babies who are going to have autism during infancy. Right now, we can identify babies who are at risk for having autism, but we cannot definitively diagnose autism in infancy.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Rebecca Landa is director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute. We have more of this interview and an extended conversation with Alyssa Rock all at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You can also hear Alyssa Rock reading from her blog. I'm Sheila Cass. Coming up, a senior portrait of a woman who's spending her retirement doing whatever pleases her. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In our first senior portraits we aired last spring, we heard from assisted living and nursing home residents who spend their time following restaurant news, staying up on motorcycle trends, and reminiscing. Today we meet Margaret, a Baltimore County resident. She worked as a surgical technician for more than 40 years, and now Margaret is enjoying the freedom that comes with retirement. She encourages other seniors to enjoy their freedom as well. Producer Jamila Kay went to a Catholic Charity senior community in Reisterstown and brings us this senior portrait.
My name is Margaret. I am a blessed 73 years old, post-op, 9 years, open-heart patient. I live a very active life. I am a Christian. Peace be still is my favorite spiritual. I love my grandchildren. I love people. I do a lot of outside activities like line dancing, weightlifting, and a lot of treadmilling. I try to keep in shape. I'm very, very busy. I can lift up to 25 pounds. Even before my surgery 9 years ago, I was very active in weight.
You had open heart surgery?
Mm-hmm. My oldest grandson, Brian, he was 9 years old. We were out shopping and we came home. And I said to him, Nana doesn't feel good. He says, Nana need a ginger ale. So he got me a ginger ale. We were home by ourselves. He was just 9. So I laid down and I got up and I said to him, Nana doesn't feel good. He said, I'll call the 911 and tell them to come get my Nana. So he did, and they came. So they took me to Northwest Hospital. I was there for 2 hours and they transferred me to Sinai and I had my open heart surgery that night. And with not one complication. I was not afraid at all. I know who was in control. So I'm blessed. I have no complaint. Because there's some people worse off than I am. So if you learn to live in the moment, forget about what might happen tomorrow, your life can be so much sweeter.
And all you've got to say.
That's Margaret. Producer Jamila Kay spoke with her at a Catholic Charities senior community in Reisterstown. We have more from Margaret on our website. Come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And tune in next Monday. We'll have another senior portrait. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Last month, longtime NPR correspondent Margot Adler died of cancer at her home in New York. A fixture at NPR since 1979, she reported for All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Weekend Edition, and she hosted NPR's Justice Talking for 9 years. She was a civil rights worker in the 1960s, and she wrote what many considered to be the definitive compendium of pagan practice in the United States. She understood that topic in part because she was a practitioner. She was a Wiccan priestess. In March of 2012, I spoke to Margot about that.
Well, you know, I don't do a lot of priestessing these days. I have too much other stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I go to a lot of festivals and events, and I lead a number of workshops in ritual and song, chanting as seamless ritual. I even occasionally do weddings. I can legally marry people, but I haven't done that in a long time.
You wrote a book called Drawing Down the Moon, Witches, Druids, Goddess Worshippers, and Other Pagans in America Today. Some people have described the topic of that book as nature religions or pagan practice. What's the common, what's the proper terminology that we should use to apply?
Well, I'd say the book is really about contemporary paganism, but also you could say contemporary nature spirituality. Here's what the way I would sort of lay it out in the sort of 2-minute version. If you go far enough back, all of us had ancestors who were pagans. Now, in some cases, that means, you know, going way, 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 way back. And in some cases, if you're like Irish, for example, it's probably only going back to like the 13th century. But if you think about who we are in America, most of those traditions were destroyed. So if you're African American, they were destroyed by slavery. If you're Native American, most of those traditions were destroyed by colonialism. If you're a basic white, regular old, you know, immigrant American who came here to this country, you're basically those traditions were destroyed by assimilation, basically wanting to Americanize as much as possible. And so what I think the pagan movement is really about, this whole contemporary drive, is to kind of reestablish some of the good things of those old traditions in modern form, the songs, the dances, the coming of age ceremonies, and the ecstatic practices, without giving up rationality, integrity, being able to go to work in the morning as an engineer or a computer programmer, but still being able to sort of dance around a bonfire at night.
Well, of course, you know, religion is front and center in the current political debate. What's your take on the status of religion and spiritual practice as it relates to the public political discourse?
Well, I think there's a lot of religion and spirituality that people don't talk about. I think the problem with the way that religion ends up being talked about in regard to the elections and so forth is that it's sort of assumed that everybody is on the same track, whereas they really aren't. There's not a lot of place for people to run for office, for example, who are atheists. There actually is a pagan who is in public office here in the East, but he's sort of reneged, and he's a Republican and a very conservative, actually. And he has sort of toned his rhetoric down about it because I think he wants to be accepted. So I think unless you're, you know, sort of Christian or Jewish, it's very hard to actually be out in the public sphere as far as running for office. And so I think our talk about religion is very, you know, it's very contained. It's very limited compared to what people are actually doing out there, whether they're doing yoga or Buddhism or they're Christians, but they're also experimenting with this, that, and the other. And I think there's a much richer religious picture in the country than we see or hear in the media.
I wonder, I mean, is there even any such thing anymore? anymore as so-called mainstream religion. I mean, if you go into a synagogue on a Friday night, they'll talk about the Jewish people as being a minority community. The Mormons talk about being a minority community. And there's so many divides within the Christian community. I mean, is there such thing as something that's considered mainstream anymore?
Well, I do think that what is considered mainstream is the idea that there is one God. So all those of us who think that maybe there's more value in multiplicity, whether you're a Hindu or you are, you know, a Tibetan Buddhist, or I think those people are much more on the outs, including the pagans. I think there's this sense that monotheism is it.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had in March of 2012 with the late NPR correspondent Margot Adler. This is not meant to be a segue, but it is, because I'm going to ask you about vampires as well. You're working on a book about how the popularity of vampires has changed throughout history. You've done a lot of reporting about vampires and vampire literature for NPR. I understand that you've read more than 200 vampire books, which is, boy.
That's kind of ridiculous.
That's a lot. That's a lot of books about
vampires. It's kind
vampires,
of ridiculous.
Mark.
Well, let me, okay. I have to start by saying that this all happened because of some tragedies in my own life, that my husband got stomach cancer and died. And while I was taking care of him, I think I was meditating on mortality and someone threw the first Twilight book at me and I kind of got obsessed and one thing led to another. So I think it started out as a meditation on mortality and immortality and dealing with death and dying. But as I went about looking at this, I started talking to academics and I started thinking, you know, why does this have so much traction in our culture right now? And what I first came across, which was really fascinating, was this idea that every culture, every society creates the vampire it needs. So, for example, to give one example, I could give you six. Bram Stoker writes Dracula, 1897. England has the largest ports in the world. What are the fears and concerns? Well, disease coming in, immigration coming in, others coming in. So you create this Eastern European monster bringing dirt from a foreign land. It's the perfect vessel for the fears and concerns of that time. So you can do this, you know, 1980s, you can do this with AIDS, you can do this with a lot of stuff. But if you then came the question, well, what's happening now? And I started realizing that ever since, I guess starting with Anne Rice, but really going much further, much more recently in the last 10 years with Buffy and then certainly with Twilight and then certainly with True Blood and all those others. If you look at the CBS show Moonlight, if you look at the Tanya Huff novels and the Lifetime TV series Blood Ties, and if you look at some of the other ones, all the vampires are very different from what went before. So the question was, so I put them all in a list and I looked at them and I went, oh my heavens. And I realized that all of our modern vampires, the ones that we like the most, have one thing in common, and that is that they are struggling desperately to be moral despite being predators. And they're failing often, and that's, I think, who we are. And I'm beginning to think that ever since the first Earth Day, we started seeing and seeing our role in the planet and the problems of the planet in peril. We started turning out vampires that were not the other that we were afraid of, but they were ourselves that we were afraid of. And they, so that they sort of became a symbol for us and our incontrollable appetites. Maybe oil is our blood, for example, or is the equivalent of blood. So that's the kind of thing that I've been thinking about a lot. As for Twilight, I think what's interesting is I think it's really been misunderstood. You know, it's all been talked about in regard to sex and return to abstinence and all that kind of stuff. I think it's really very different. I think that, and maybe I come to this because I'm an only child, as Bella was, and I looked at, you know, what her life was in those books and movies, and it was pretty boring compared to the two families that she was choosing between, one of which was deeply tribal and extended family and much more interesting than her own, and the other which was intellectual and educated and so forth. So I think it's really a story about identity and choices, and I think much more about issues of power, identity, than it is about sex.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a 2012 conversation with Margot Adler, the NPR correspondent who passed away last month. I asked Margot how her interest in paganism and spirituality might inform her work as a journalist.
Well, you know, it was just, you know, I keep on thinking that if I came to them now with the background I have, they'd never hire me. You know, my book was out right at the time I got hired. And I had also had a previous 7 or 8 years at another radio station, at a radio station that I'd worked at where, so that I think that, does it inform my work? Yes and no. I mean, part of my, I think that what's interesting to me about journalism is I really am interested in stories that kind of turn the world upside down, that say, you thought it was this way, but it's really much more interesting and much more complex. And I'm not sure how much that has to do with paganism and spirituality, but I think it has a lot to do with just looking at the world and looking at the way people live their lives and realizing that the stories that you hear in most of the media don't really convey the depth and interest that they really have and are.
I mean, I wonder if a reporter has a particular spiritual perspective, and I imagine that virtually all of us do, is that analogous at all to having a particular political perspective? You know, and I think about the incidences in which reporters and journalists are associated with various causes and they run into trouble. I mean, should it matter that they're involved with these causes on their own time?
I personally have a real problem with this whole, I have a problem with the entire understanding that the modern day mainstream media has about impartiality. I believe that you have to be fair. I believe that you can't, you know, give money to an organization that you're covering and so forth and so on, that there can't be conflicts of interest. But I actually believe that in a way you're more honest if you're out front about what you in fact believe. And that there are all kinds of reporters out there, not for NPR I'm talking about, but just out there, who think that they're totally objective because they really don't even realize what their own biases are. I think people who are more out front about that are in a very different category. I've had a huge life of political activism. I'm very careful now. I'm doing a lot of coverage of the Occupy movement, and I certainly don't in any way, I'm not in any way a part of the Occupy movement. I don't do anything that's not being a reporter for the Occupy movement. But, you know, as I do this and as I go around, I think, you know, a lot of the strictures, I think, against journalism, I think are, I'm not sure, I think they're a little short-sighted.
NPR correspondent Margot Adler. She's the author of several books, including Drawing Down the Moon and a memoir, Heretic's Heart. The book about vampires that she was working on when we talked in 2012 was published as a Kindle single on Amazon in June of 2013. It's called Out for Blood. We've got a link for more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Margot Adler died of cancer on July 28th. She was 68 years old. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Thanks for listening.